When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Well, let's say you had the job. Someone does, right? The job of briefing Donald Trump on his legal problems every day. What would you say today? Where would you begin? He is already, remember, every day, he's already defending Trump in several civil cases, from E. Jean Carroll's lawsuit claiming Donald Trump raped her in the 1990s to some Capitol Police officers' lawsuits against Donald Trump for causing their injuries and other injuries in the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And those lawsuits, especially the Capitol Police lawsuits, are still on track today to totally bankrupt Donald Trump eventually, hitting him with verdicts of hundreds of millions of dollars in damages that he will have to pay, but they are moving at that standard slow pace of civil litigation, so that will take years. I think if you were briefing Donald Trump on his legal troubles today, you might, and I'm only saying might, lead with the Justice Department's filing in a Florida federal court asking to block the release of the affidavit that convinced a federal judge to issue a search warrant of Donald Trump's Florida home, which was executed by the FBI exactly one extremely long week ago. Or you might lead with this breaking news from the New York Times late in the day today. Alan H. Weisselberg, a senior executive at Donald J. Trump's family business, who was charged with participating in a years-long tax scheme, is nearing a deal with Manhattan prosecutors, but will not cooperate with a broader investigation into Mr. Trump, according to three people with knowledge of the matter. On Monday, Mr. Weisselberg's lawyers and prosecutors met with the judge overseeing the case. The judge scheduled a hearing for Thursday, a possible indication that a deal has been reached and a plea could be entered then. Mr. Weisselberg was expected to receive a 5-month jail sentence with time credited for good behavior. He is likely to serve about 100 days. If you were briefing Donald Trump on his legal troubles today, it's really a tough choice because you might want to lead with the federal grand jury in Washington, D.C., issuing a subpoena to former White House lawyer Eric Hirschman. And if you weren't quite sure how important that is, it would quickly rise in importance once you read that our first guest tonight, former federal prosecutor Andrew Weissman, said today that he believes that this subpoena to Eric Hirschman means that Donald Trump himself is a target of the grand jury investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol and the attempt to overthrow the election. Here is what Eric Hirschman told the January 6th committee about Trump attorney John Eastman, whose phone was seized by the FBI.
John, now I'm going to give you the best free legal advice you're ever getting in your life. Get a great effing criminal defense lawyer. You're going to need it. And then I hung up on him.
The New York Times and other news organizations have requested that the Florida judge who issued the search warrant for Donald Trump's home release the FBI affidavit that laid out the criminal case or cases that are being investigated with that search warrant. In a brief to the judge today, the Justice Department said disclosure at this juncture of the affidavit supporting probable cause would, by contrast, cause significant and irreparable damage to this ongoing criminal investigation. As the court is aware from its review of the affidavit, it contains, among other critically important and detailed investigative facts, highly sensitive information about witnesses, including witnesses interviewed by the government, specific investigative techniques, and information required by law to be kept under seal pursuant to Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 6E. If disclosed, the affidavit would serve as a roadmap to the government's ongoing investigation, providing specific details about its direction and likely course in a manner that is likely, highly likely, to compromise future investigative steps. In addition, information about witnesses is particularly sensitive, given the high-profile nature of this matter and the risk that the revelation of witness identities would impact their willingness to cooperate with the investigation. Disclosure of the government's affidavit at this stage would also likely chill future cooperation by witnesses whose assistance may be sought as this investigation progresses, as well as in other high-profile investigations. The fact that this investigation implicates highly classified materials further underscores the need to protect the integrity of the investigation and exacerbates the potential for harm if information is disclosed to the public prematurely or improperly. That is a heavily loaded filing, loaded with references to witness identities. That alone is going to leave Donald Trump wondering all night who they are. And the phrase full, it is full of extra bad news for Donald Trump. And that bad news is the reference to other high-profile investigations. Other high-profile investigations? That's the Department of Justice saying that the evidence and witness identities, especially in the Trump search warrant affidavit, could compromise not only the investigation that the search warrant is about, but, quote, other high-profile investigations. The other high-profile federal investigation that we know about is the criminal investigation of the January 6th attack on the Capitol and the extended attempt, generally, to illegally overturn the election. Leading off our discussion tonight is Andrew Weissman, former FBI general counsel and former chief of the criminal division in the Eastern District of New York and professor of practice at NYU Law School. He is an MSNBC legal analyst. Also with us is Bradley Moss, a national security attorney. Andrew, I won't ask you to pretend you're briefing Donald Trump on what his biggest problems are, but let's just go to your class. Let's go to your NYU Law School class. And you are presenting to your class today, based on everything we've seen, just in today's revelations, what is the lead in all of this for you?
I think the lead would be the thing that's coming up the fastest, which is the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. It could be that in a few days, Alan Weisselberg, the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, actually pleads guilty. The reason that's important for Donald Trump is the Trump Organization is scheduled for trial in October. Once Alan Weisselberg pleads guilty, it's over for the Trump Organization. The crimes he committed gets imputed to the Trump Organization. So the leverage in terms of the financial consequences to Donald Trump doesn't mean he's going to go to jail, but the consequences for the Trump Organization are huge. And remember, for those people who think Donald Trump did this in part for money, that he's venal, this is a big deal. So I think that would be number one, is to focus on the financial consequences of the Alan Weisselberg deal. And then down the road, I mean, you, Lawrence, laid out a litany of criminal and national security trouble in Florida, in D.C., in Georgia. I mean, this was a day where you saw a movement on all fronts. And to me, the thing that I thought was probably the most telling was the grand jury subpoena to Eric Hirschman. There's a guy who can completely corroborate what we heard from Cassidy Hutchinson. I'm sure he has information also on the search warrant issues. For instance, I can't imagine he's going to corroborate the idea that there was a standing order to declassify everything. I mean, Eric Hirschman seems like somebody who would say that was preposterous. So that is a very bad fact in terms of signaling that Merrick Garland is really, I think, putting his foot on the gas.
And Bradley Moss, in this filing with the court, they openly refer to other high-profile investigations being possibly affected by the revelation of everything that's in that affidavit.
Yeah, which makes you wonder, what exactly else are they going after? We know that there's other sealed entries, another search warrant. We don't know what it is, what it was for, and to whom it went. And it makes you, kind of question, okay, how many different tentacles does this thing have? There's obviously the classified information aspect. is obviously, to the extent, and Andrew mentioned this, you know, January 6th. Is there something else we don't know about? Is it other individuals in play that we don't know about yet? So if you're Donald Trump, this has to be quite possibly one of the two worst weeks of your life since you almost went bankrupt in the 90s. Everything is going against you right now. And, you know, you've got all these different investigations. Rudy Giuliani is a target in Georgia now, as we know. Weisselberg's going to plead guilty on Thursday. You know, it just keeps getting worse. And you have to wonder, you know, if you're looking at all this, what else comes up now? What's the next shoe to drop?
And Andrew Weissman, of course, Lindsey Graham shifted his goalposts from show us the warrant to show us the affidavit. This affidavit makes actual legal case in addition to the substance of what's in it, but mentioning that it involves possible, it does involve 6E information. What are they referring to there?
So the application by the government is they opposed turning over the affidavit in a really well-written and I think pretty well-reasoned brief. And what they were saying is there's an ongoing criminal investigation that is active, and there's an ongoing national security investigation. The former, the ongoing criminal investigation, is covered by something called Rule 6E. That is grand jury material. Whatever happens in the grand jury is covered by Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 6E, and that cannot be revealed without a court order. So that filing made it clear that there is an ongoing investigation. And although at times they use different terms, it's pretty clear that it involves national security and a criminal investigation, which I thought was quite telling because, you know, for a long time, people were speculating whether the search in Mar-a-Lago was simply to retrieve documents and just how much did the government really care about the criminal aspect. Well, they now have set out directly to a judge that there is an ongoing active criminal investigation. So, as Brian said, that is another bad day for Donald Trump.
And Bradley Moss, we have heard, I'm not sure I even want to call them defenses, but we've heard things said by Donald Trump and by his advocates since Friday, since we learned what was in the search warrant. It's kind of a rolling mix of stuff. Have you heard anything from Donald Trump or the people around him that sounds like a legal defense for what that search warrant was aimed at?
No, not much. Most of this is just cable news, you know, as Joe Biden would say, cable news malarkey. It's not going to go anywhere. You couldn't bring up most of this in court. And bear in mind, you've seen tons of cable news commentary from Donald Trump's lawyers. They're all over Fox. They're all over Newsmax and OAN. But where have we not seen them? In court. They're not filing anything in court. They're not seeking an emergency temporary restraining order. They're not seeking to squash the search warrant. They're not filing for a special master. If they had true merit to these allegations, any competent lawyer, any lawyer trying to really protect their client there would have already gone to court, but they don't have it. What they have is political arguments and post hoc rationalizations. They don't have a true legal defense yet.
And Andrew Weissman, something else we learned about the Trump lawyers over the weekend is that at least one of them signed a document indicating that anything that was classified, that there was nothing classified left at Mar-a-Lago, that the search warrant has proved that not to be true.
Yeah, so that is going to be a problem either for the lawyer or for Donald Trump. I mean, if the lawyer got those representations from Donald Trump himself can be charged with making the false statement through his counsel. That's, in fact, what we did with Paul Manafort, and he pled guilty to it. On the other hand, if the lawyer just did it on his own and it was false, that also is going to lead to potential charges. And you can be sure the Department of Justice is going to be all over that representation.
Andrew Weissman and Bradley Moss, thank you very much for starting us off tonight. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Almost certainly a lie. Those are the exact words of what Donald Trump's national security advisor said about one of the possible defenses Donald Trump has offered for having classified material illegally stored at his home in Florida. Glenn Gritzel, former counsel for the National Security Agency, will join us next.
Get the best of MSNBC all in one place every day, each morning in your inbox with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Understand today's news. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
When somebody begins to concoct lies like this, it shows a real level of desperation. That is what Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor John Bolton said about Donald Trump's claim that he had a standing order that any classified documents that he took from the Oval Office to anywhere else in the residence in the White House automatically became declassified. John Bolton told the New York Times he had never heard of the standing order that Mr. Trump's office claimed to have in place. It is, he said, almost certainly a lie. Joining us now is Glenn Gerstel, former general counsel for the National Security Agency. He served in the Obama administration and the Trump administration. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Let me begin by saying I don't know anything about classification law, and I'm not sure how much of it, as regards the president, is actually written in federal statute, and how much of it is tradition, how much of it is a sort of set of assumptions and rules. We've discovered in so many other areas of government that what we thought was rock solid turns out to be, to a great extent, gentlemen's agreements and things that are not written in law as solidly as we thought they were. What do we need to know about what is written in law about the president's authority on classification and, in this case, instant declassification?
Well, you know, since the time of President Truman, we've had a detailed procedure in place for protecting our nation's secrets, the secrets that we need to keep our nation safe in peacetime and in wartime. That's enshrined in statutes, in executive orders that have been honored under both Republican and Democratic administrations, in intelligence community directives, Pentagon manuals, and so on and so forth. There's a rich system in place for determining when to classify something and how it should be classified, including as applies to the president himself, as well as declassifying. That's the other side of the coin, to make sure we're not releasing something that's inappropriate. As you would expect, these provisions relate mostly to lesser officers than the president. We don't really need to have a particular provision directed to the president himself or herself, because it's obvious that they would be following the law. And for, you know, 200 years, we've had a republic in which the president has followed scrupulously the laws and conventions and takes an oath of office to do just that.
So on this notion that as soon as Donald Trump took a document from the Oval Office, maybe walked up the stairs to the residence, that it automatically became declassified, what is your reaction to that when you heard it? What did you think?
I think it's pretty hard to believe that. First of all, let's assume, just for argument's sake, that he in fact had such a standing order, even though apparently no one seems to be aware of it or can find a copy of it, and his former chief of staff, who would certainly be expected to know of it, wasn't aware of it. Even if you make that assumption that there was such an order and that the president had the power to do that, both of which are big assumptions, in the real world, the practicality of it just falls apart and it becomes almost very quickly nonsense. And what I mean by that is there's no way of knowing exactly what the president on a given day took upstairs with him, and at what point did it become declassified? Was it the third step, the fourth step, the top step? What if he decided to come back downstairs and bring a piece of paper downstairs? I'm picking sort of somewhat silly examples, because my point is we have no way of knowing exactly what was covered by this. And why is that important? Because If indeed there was going to be some kind of automatic declassification, the agencies of the federal government would need to know what that is so that the next morning, when a Freedom of Information Act request is posed or a member of the public asks for information, they would have the ability to look at a logbook, as is done, has been done historically for decades, and say, yes, this piece of paper was declassified or still remains classified. And if we simply have a system where at the whim of someone, a piece of paper might or might not be subject to that, and we have no way of knowing, we can't tell afterwards, we're not going to have an effective way of safeguarding our nation's secrets.
You don't have to apologize for giving silly examples. It's a silly proposition, so you don't have any option other than silly examples to suggest. Let me read you a passage from The Atlantic that Graham Wood has written about his understanding of how big the presidential power is here. He says, he would not have had to file paperwork, just utter the magic words. He's citing a former director of the Security Oversight Office saying that. He could have waved his hand over the U-Haul trailer as it headed out of the White House driveway and down I-95 toward Florida, and there would have been no classified material in there to mishandle. What's your reaction to that description?
I just don't think that makes sense. We've got a system where we have to keep track of the nation's secrets, and it can't possibly be the case that putting aside the pure technical legal power, just put that aside for a second, we can't have a system where we don't know what is covered in a bunch of boxes that may be in the trailer that you described heading down I-95. We have no way of knowing what's classified or declassified. What if the president, for example, who apparently keeps the nuclear codes to launch an attack, God forbid, on his person as he's required to by law, the so-called football that travels around with him and other materials, did he bring that upstairs to the residence? Presumably he did. It's required to be kept about, with sort of within reach. Was that declassified? Hard to believe that. And did that happen every single day? Hard to believe. So just the sheer practicality of this just doesn't make sense in our system.
Excuse me. Glenn Klester, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Here's something else you'd have to include if you were briefing Donald Trump today on what's happening out there in the legal world. Today, Rudy Giuliani was told that, yes, he is a target of the criminal investigation by Fulton County District Attorney Fawnie Willis of possible election fraud in Georgia's 2020 presidential election. Prosecutors informed Rudy Giuliani's lawyers today that he is a target before his scheduled testimony to the grand jury on Wednesday. Also today, a federal judge in Atlanta ruled that Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham must testify to Fawnie Willis's grand jury in Fulton County, Georgia. The judge rejected Senator Graham's argument that he cannot be compelled to testify because he was acting in his official Senate duties when he made a phone call to Georgia's Secretary of State asking about vote counting in the presidential election. The judge said the district attorney has shown extraordinary circumstances and a special need for Senator Graham's testimony on issues relating to alleged attempts to influence or disrupt the lawful administration of Georgia's 2022 elections. Lindsey Graham is scheduled to testify to that grand jury next week. Senator Graham said he plans to appeal the ruling. Joining us now is Glenn Kirshner, former federal prosecutor and an MSNBC legal analyst. And Glenn, I think some of us at some level have expected this day for quite a while. Rudy Giuliani officially named a target of a criminal investigation. What does that change for Giuliani and for Donald Trump?
Yeah, Lawrence, Rudy Giuliani's resume really took a turn for the worse today because, you know, on the one hand, yes, he's the former New York City mayor. He's a former United States attorney. He is the former personal attorney to the president of the United States. But now he has to include on his resume that he is the target of a criminal investigation into election fraud. And there's a technical definition of target. And I actually pulled out my old U.S. Attorney's Manual. That's sort of the procedural Bible by which we federal prosecutors do business. And it's a definition of target that is pretty much universally accepted, even this in the state systems. And I want to read it verbatim. A target is a person as to whom the prosecutor or the grand jury has substantial evidence linking him or her to the commission of a crime and who, in the judgment of the prosecutor, is a putative defendant. And I can translate that into English, Lawrence. A target is the guy we're looking to indict.
But not necessarily the only guy in any particular grand jury.
No, we can have multiple targets. And the fact that Rudy Giuliani's lawyers were just put on notice by District Attorney Fani Willis that he is a target in the grand jury's investigation does not preclude other targets. We all sort of know, based on the way the evidence has developed, that Donald Trump is a likely target. And then we may be hearing Lindsey Graham sort of earning himself the distinguished title of target the way things are going.
So what happens for Giuliani in the grand jury? Just plead the Fifth Amendment to every question?
Yeah, the practical implications are once a prosecutor has told you you are a target, that gives you an easy vehicle to invoke your Fifth Amendment right of self against self-incrimination because you've been told we are looking to indict you. Now, he doesn't have to invoke the Fifth. He could certainly waive the Fifth and testify truthfully about the crimes of Donald Trump, but he would also have to testify truthfully about any crimes he may have committed. And I think it unlikely that Rudy will go that route.
So at this stage, the most likely choice for Giuliani is the Fifth Amendment at the grand jury. Then what's the prosecutor's choice?
So the prosecutor's choice will be to proceed with the investigation. And the fact that DA Willis has already announced that Rudy Giuliani is a target of the criminal probe suggests to us that she has met that threshold to have somebody designated a target. Substantial evidence linking him to the crime and an intent to indict. So he can invoke the Fifth, and you know that may give him some momentary comfort because he won't be compelled to incriminate himself, but that does not stop Fani Willis from asking the grand jury to indict Rudy Giuliani.
What did Donald Trump's lawyers see in this development?
Well, listen, if he ends up being criminally indicted for any number of violations of Georgia state law, then that certainly ratchets up the pressure. And we prosecutors say pressure bursts pipes. So I think that will increase the odds that Rudy Giuliani may decide to save himself and flip, turn and cooperate against Donald Trump.
Let's go to the New York State case with Alan Weisselberg, where New York Times are reporting you could have a guilty plea from him by Thursday. Once he's pled guilty, once he has pleaded guilty, he can then be called as a witness by prosecutors in other matters, and he has no ability at that point to plead the Fifth Amendment, does he?
That's a great point. Once you plead guilty, then that extinguishes your right against self-incrimination because your truthful testimony will no longer incriminate you because of the double jeopardy prohibition. So he could be compelled to testify, but that doesn't mean, Lawrence, he can be compelled to tell the truth. It looks like he is taking what's called a soldier's plea. When somebody just says, I will take my hit, I will do my time, but I am not going to flip on the bigger fish. If he's willing to sort of hold fast like that, I think, you know, threatening additional time because we try to compel your testimony and you may opt to lie rather than give up Donald Trump is not likely to have much of an effect.
Glenn Kirshner, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Lawrence.
Thank you. And coming up, President Biden's strategic mastery of the 50-50 Senate has led to another big legislative win with a bill signing tomorrow. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, will join us next.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Only one president in our history had to deal with a 50-50 Senate before Joe Biden. George W. Bush had a 50-50 Senate, but only for 5 months. And that is when the Bush tax cuts were passed through the Senate. But it wasn't even close, with 62 votes in favor of the tax cuts. No president has ever successfully designed a legislative strategy to get legislation through the Senate with the support of only the 50 members of his party. No one has ever done that, no president, before Joe Biden. And Joe Biden has done it for his entire legislative agenda. He has done it for the appointment of a record number of federal judges, including Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. The two best presidential legislative strategists prior to Joe Biden were Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson, both of whom had huge Democratic majorities in the Senate and in the House. Joe Biden's list of accomplishments with the 50-50 Senate make him the single best legislative strategist in the history of the presidency. And at this point, he appears to be in the running, running third probably to Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson in terms of real legislative achievements. He might be in a tie for third with President Obama, who passed the historic Affordable Care Act. Tomorrow, President Biden will cap his legislative achievements in this Congress with the oddly named Inflation Reduction Act, which is really about corporate tax fairness and climate policy. Joe Biden has always welcomed Republican votes when he could get them, as he did with the infrastructure bill. But when it became clear that every Republican in the Senate and the House would oppose the Inflation Reduction Act, President Biden pushed it through with the team that supported him for the presidency in the House and the Senate. And he did it with the Democrats standing alone in both the House and the Senate. Joining us now is Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington State. She is the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and a member of the House Judiciary Committee. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. It seems with the election calendar and the recess calendar, we are probably at the end of the Biden legislative agenda for this two-year Congress. And it has ended with this achievement on climate policy in particular, which is the single largest piece of legislation ever to pass through these bodies on that subject.
That's exactly right, Lawrence. And he deserves, President Biden deserves enormous credit for coming in with an agenda that was transformative, that was expansive, that was popular and populist, and address the needs of working people across the country. And he has not given up on that agenda. And I'm very proud to say, I think the Congressional Progressive Caucus has been one of his best friends on Capitol Hill in terms of getting many of these things done. But this is an enormous achievement for Democrats across the board to cut carbon emissions by 40% by 2030, to take on the negotiation of prescription drug pricing, as you know, a very tough thing to even get your toe in the door for, bring down the cost of insulin, and make the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share. It's a huge amount of good for the country, and it gives us hope as we're out there in the next couple of months making the case for why we need a couple more Democrats in the Senate, a slightly expanded majority there, and of course to keep and hopefully expand our House majority so that we can get the rest of the president's economic agenda done.
Yeah, this drama of having exactly 50 Democratic senators is like really like nothing we've ever seen before, because when it happened before, it was only for a few months. This has been on everything. And we all knew as soon as we saw that formation, by the time we knew it was going to be 50-50 in the Senate, we knew that that meant on the Democratic side, every single Democratic senator, each one of them could stop anything that that Democratic senator might want to stop. That in created a tremendous tension in the Senate.
Yes, it did. And I will just point out that not every Democratic senator did that. Only one or two did.
Right,
and
right.
I think that that is really important, because I know I've heard Senator Sanders saying he could hold this entire Senate hostage to get Medicare for All in, for example, or something like that. But he hasn't. And I think the reality is that we have to celebrate the wins, but we also have to recognize that with the stuff that was left on the cutting room floor, things that are very important to the economic agenda, to the ability for the economy to recover, like childcare, universal pre-K, housing, investments in housing, particularly as these costs are the ones that are rising across the country, one measure of success is that, Lawrence, we got 99% of Democrats on board with this agenda, a very progressive agenda that is the president's agenda. The majority of the country agrees with us. And thanks to the Progressive Caucus, we got legislation drafted. So as soon as we get those additional senators, couple senators in the Senate, we actually have text. We have the opportunity to do another reconciliation bill. We can pass the rest of the president's economic agenda in the next, as soon as we get that majority. So I hope people across the country understand it's not just the success of passing legislation. Obviously, that is the final and most important goal, but there's work that has to be done to get us there. And Lawrence, we are so close in terms of the rest of this agenda.
Well, there's also that lesson to be learned, I think, for, especially for people who might. And every time there's a new president, there's a new set of younger people watching this kind of thing for the first time, is that the story of legislation is seldom told in one try or one attempt. It is usually we tried, we didn't get it. Then we tried it again in the next Congress. We got a little bit of it. And then the Congress after that, we got a big bunch of it. And so it goes. And we're seeing that pretty much all of the Biden agenda in some form has now gotten through, not in the original form proposed, because it pretty much never gets through in the original form proposed.
That's right. And I think we are not talking here about incremental changes. I think that's a really important point. We're talking about dramatic transformations of the way the economy works and making the economy work for regular working people instead of the wealthiest. And these kinds of transformations do require some time to get the idea socialized, to get the legislation drafted and debated. Don't forget, Lawrence, that when the infrastructure bill came to us in the House, there was no Build Back Better Act. There was no legislation. There were no negotiations. And I was on your show multiple times talking about why we had to hold the line, which we did until we passed Build Back Better. Those provisions, so many of the provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act came directly from that other piece of legislation. And so much of what we want to do next is already outlined. It is already agreed upon. It is already debated. We literally just need a couple votes in the Senate. And that gives me a lot of hope. And I really hope it gives a lot of people who have been part of this movement a lot of hope, too, because these are not incremental changes. These are transformations in how our economy works and how the United States leads the rest of the world.
Representative Pramila Jayapal, thank you very much for joining us once again tonight. Always appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Lawrence.
We'll be right back. Time for tonight's last word.
Faithful adherence to the rule of law is the bedrock principle of the Justice Department and of our democracy. Upholding the rule of law means applying the law evenly, without fear or favor. Under my watch, that is precisely what the Justice Department is doing.
The 86th Attorney General of the United States, Merrick Garland, gets tonight's last word.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.